He dropped the ball, but when I hit him, I lowered my head too much. I remember I spun around. I crushed two cervical vertebrae in my neck and badly damaged my spinal cord. And so after I hit, I spin around. I'm laying kind of face down on the ground with my head turned to the right. And so, and I can see, you know, through my helmet, I can see my right arm, which was only 12 or 13 inches away from my head or from my face. But man, it's weird. It was like it wasn't even my arm. It wasn't even attached to me. And I remember going through the motion of trying to get up, and I watched my arm just roll over. And when I watched it roll over, I couldn't feel it roll over. I couldn't feel anything. And that was the last movement I had for, you know, at least another month.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Rod, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually found out about your story by way of somebody who knew you. And when I read, you know, sort of the description of your life story, I thought, yeah, this is definitely something that really resonates with me. But before we get into all that, I want to start by asking what I think is a very relevant question, given where this begins. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
You mean social group being like the popular kids, or?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Okay. Well, I would have to say I was definitely one of the popular kids, and probably one of the leaders of the popular kids. And that was even after my injury and after everything, and my paralysis that resulted, in junior high. So my ninth grade year, which I was in junior high, that was kind of my last year of being physically normal. And I was, you know, the quarterback on the football team, played basketball, baseball, and actually did very well academically too, even before the injury. Then the injury happens before I'm even a student in high school. And so I come in as a sophomore in high school after the injury. And, but, you know, it's amazing how things kind of plug back in to normal, but still part of the popular group. But, you know, one thing, you know, and it's interesting you asked that question. I think one thing that's interesting is, you know, even though, you know, I was certainly in the popular group, you know, and I know, I think maybe today in high school, it's a lot more cliquey. Back when I was in high school, you didn't have that much clickiness. I mean, I probably had a group of, you know, 50 friends that were, you know, we were all friends. There really wasn't a lot of, pointing to the, hey, look at that group of nerds or something like that. We just didn't really do that. You know, you'd go to the cafeteria to eat lunch, and, you know, you'd sit with, you know, different people every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people who don't have any context about the injury, take us to that moment, because, you know, like I said, before we hit record here, as I was reading the story, I was like, wait a minute, this is literally the first episode of Friday Night Lights in your life story. When I was as hearing that, so take us to that moment. But I do want to ask you quite a bit about playing football, because that's one of those things that, especially quarterbacks, are people that I've always been fascinated by.
Okay, sure. Well, okay. So I said, I'm coming into high school. I'm 15 years old. Finished, you know, junior high in the ninth grade, that would have been around May. That summer, I'm practicing all summer, just doing drills and just practicing football, getting ready for the fall. The week before school's supposed to start, this high school where I went, which was South Stokes High School in Walnut Cove, North Carolina, To give you some context, I mean, a country high school. The largest city to us was Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We were north of Winston-Salem. We're about maybe 30 minutes north of Winston-Salem. So we start the week before high school. We had those that want to play football. We went to what's called football camp, and so everybody lived at the high school. We had sleeping bags and we slept in the classrooms for a week and practiced, had just intense practices for that entire week. I was a pretty good athlete, and I was one of the fortunate ones. Only two sophomores made the varsity, and I was one of them. So at the end of the week, we had the inter-squad scrimmage where we're dressed out, full uniforms like we were going to play a regular game. The scrimmage is open to the whole town. Place is full of people. I've never played on a stage that large in my life. It's all, junior highs. That was the largest, no big stadiums with, the really manicured grass. And, so this was a pretty big deal for me. So I'm a little jacked up when I'm out there. So I was actually the starting free safety. I'd earned the starting free safety job just in football camp and was, was pushing to be the starting quarterback, but just hadn't gotten there yet. So how it happened in the scrimmage, we broke up into, we started with the first string defense, going to play an offense, but back then, as opposed to now, the really good players played both ways. Now you have a separate offense and a separate defense typically. And so the offense was kind of a, makeshift kind of put together type offense just to give us a look and to run some plays against us. The tight end on that offense, who was typically the starting guard on offense, just for fun, he split out and played tight end. And this kid was about 6'3", probably weighed 265, 270, a huge guy. Went on to play college football at Wake Forest. So he goes to tight end. I'm playing free safety, and I'm probably 6 feet, maybe weigh 160. So I'm not, at this point in my life, I hadn't been in the gym to, I'm just not old enough. I've been in junior high. This tight end was a senior, had been, lifting weights for 3 solid years. The first play was a pass across the middle. I saw him, come across the line, saw the quarterback, tracked his eyes, saw where he was going with the ball. Couldn't get there fast enough to intercept it. But when the ball got close, when it hit his hands, I hit him as hard as I could. And, I was kind of jacked up. I wanted to show everybody there, new guy here. I want to show everybody how hard I can hit. And I did. And, he dropped the ball, but when I hit him, I lowered my head too much. I mean, not an intentional trying to spear him or anything. But hit him hard, hit him on the crown of my head, my helmet hit the top of his thigh. And when I hit, I remember I spun around, I crushed 2 cervical vertebrae in my neck and badly damaged my spinal cord. And so after I hit, I spin around, I'm laying kind of face down on the ground with my head turned to the right. And so, and I can see through my helmet, I can see my right arm, which was only 12, 13 inches away from my head or from my face. But, it's weird. It was like it wasn't even my arm. It wasn't even attached to me. And I remember going through the motion of trying to get up, and I watched my arm just roll over. And when I watched it roll over, I couldn't feel it roll over. I couldn't feel anything. And that was the last movement I had for, at least another month. Yeah. So that's kind of a breaking point in the story, if you want me to stop there.
Yeah. No, so, I remember because it was it was in the very beginning of the book, you said, I was 15 years old in 1981 when I broke my neck playing high school football. And you mentioned that, you were, one of the most heralded athletes in the school's history. And you said, one game I threw for over 400 yards and 5 touchdowns. I averaged 20 points in a game in basketball. I played baseball and ran track. You seem like you're almost this athletic phenom as a freshman who was destined for really, really big sort of athletic success. And to have something like that happen so early, what did that do for your sense of identity? Because, I've talked to people who are professional athletes, and when their career ends, whether it's through an injury or whether it's through just the shelf life of an athlete, this is one of the biggest challenges they have, is finding who they are in, you know, after something that has defined them for so long.
Right. Well, you know, what may be a little bit different from me than like these professional athletes is I was so young when this happened. I mean, only being 15 years old, but really my whole life before then, I mean, athletics was such a large part of it. And I tell you, it was kind of hard in the book just to, you know, list some of my stats because I didn't want to come off as, you know, bragging or anything. But I thought it was necessary to kind of set the table or set the tone as to kind of, you know, this was a kind of a far fall from really being kind of that good. But as far as the how it changed my identity, like I said, all right, so I'm only 15. And so the truth of the matter is, I don't think the 15-year-old brain could really comprehend what had happened. And we can talk about going through the next 3.5 months of rehab and then back to school.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, when I plugged back into school, my identity, I don't think it changed at all. And it's because, you know, I was pretty smart. You know, I made really good grades, you know, before this injury. And then I continued to make good grades. My identity changed as an athlete, and there were some tough times about that. I remember, especially like going to basketball games and sitting in the stands, watching my friends play and doing well, knowing that if I were out there, I would be doing just as well and just having a good time. And here I am, you know, no longer an athlete, sitting in the bleachers. And that was kind of tough. I'll admit that. And that was tough to get over. But as far as my identity and far as my life went, when I plugged back into school, personality wise, the way I was treated by my friends, my competitive drive, especially my competitive drive, it didn't end with the injury.
Yeah. Well, so I want to come back to this, but I have to ask you about the actual experience of becoming this good, because I played one semester of seventh grade junior high football in Texas. And you know this from playing football in Texas, there are seventh graders the size of grown men. As a scrawny Indian kid, I quickly realized football was not for me. I even remember when the coach called me in eighth grade, he's like, "Are you coming out for football this year?" I was like, "Why would I come out for football to get the shit beat out of me?" Like, it was the kind of thing where, you know, those tackling drills where this was my hero moment. Like, the coach complimented some kid who wanted to be a wide receiver who volunteered to play center. And I was like, and the coach was like, "I need a guard." And I thought, "Oh, this is it. This is my perfect opportunity to be validated by the coach." And so we get up, we do these tackling drills, you know, when you have lineman drills, and literally it was me against this huge kid, and he pushed me back like 20 yards and everybody just started laughing. And I think that was my moment where I realized, all right, this is not meant to be. But what is it that leads to the level of skill and performance that somebody like you had, particularly at such a young age? Like, what enabled that?
Well, I think you have to have some natural ability or some God-given ability. But I tell you, I think why, you know, I became a good athlete is when I was a kid, I was outside playing constantly. I mean, I was, you know, there wasn't any, you know how it is today with video games and that kind of stuff. There was none of that. And I was outside. I mean, I would... You know, I started playing backyard football when I was 5 years old, and just played and played and played. And I think that just that the constant you develop early, you develop your athletic skills, out there, by doing it. And I think that had a lot to do with it. But I mean, there's just different people have different talent levels. I mean, you know, some people are smarter than others. Some people are better looking than others. And some people are better athletes than others. You know, you get what you get. I must have had some natural ability because, I did well, you know, even starting in Little League football, you know, I did well. And I did well in basketball also. well, actually, and baseball too, but just, it's natural talent plus playing a lot. I remember in junior high, my buddy and I used to, in the summertime, we would play basketball one-on-one, hours. In the hot sun.
I remember doing that as well.
Yeah. We just played and played and played. And that's how you get better, is by playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I remember in seventh grade, I was the most improved player on my basketball team. And I will always joke, I was like, that just means you're the shittiest player on the team. But I remember the summer between seventh and eighth grade, my math teacher coached the girls basketball team, and he had watched when we practiced. He said, wow, you've gotten a lot better. One other question about this. So I remember that seventh grade summer when I played, and you know this from, being out in the heat in the North Carolina, in the Texas humidity and heat, you get out there and you're thinking, this is going to be so much fun and amazing. And the moment you put on those pads and you put on those helmets, you realize I'm going to get sick or I'm going to throw up. And I had two friends who were huge kids and they quit after 2 days, and I stuck it out the entire season. Why do you think that is? Like, what is it that differentiates people? Because they definitely were far more probably prone to actually succeed than I was.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Well, what it is that makes some people stick it out and some not. I'm going to guess, for your situation and for mine too, you probably had parents that instilled the thought process in your head that once you start something, you're going to finish it. Yeah. And, you're not going to be a quitter. I couldn't imagine, and not just sports, but just quitting anything in the middle of it. If I've committed to doing something, man, I couldn't imagine. And it's just how I was brought up. It's how I was raised.
Well, I mean, now that I know the timeline of the 80s, and you mentioned you're in Mobile, Alabama, and just given our current context, I have to ask, what were race relations like at the time when you grew up, and how did sports play a role in that?
Well, man, that's a great question. And let me go back to, I put this in the book, and I put it in there for the, for a specific reason, to talk about race relations a little bit. And of course, it was part of my growing up. But before I moved to King, North Carolina, when we went to the seventh grade, and that's where I was throughout the rest of my junior high and high school, I lived in a town called Emporia, Virginia. Now, Emporia is probably about 50%, at least 50% Black, 50% white. That was the first time I'd ever gone to, public elementary school when there were, just as many Black kids as white kids. Although, as far as I'm concerned, in that town, the race relations I had with my friends who were Black kids was really good. However, in that town, it was still segregated, as far as the youth sports teams. Not that there were any rules that, hey, no Blacks can come over and play in the white league. And I think maybe one or two would, but it was just, it's just kind of the culture of the town. But it's interesting that when we moved to that town, I think we were there only 2 years. The first year, my brother's a year older than I am, we played in the, football in the white league. Well, the next year, my dad decided that he wanted to. My dad always wanted to coach us, and he wouldn't. They wouldn't allow him to coach in the white team. So he went over to it was called the Community Youth Center, CYC. That's where all the Black kids went, and he coached that team. And my brother and I, there was about 60 kids on the team, so there's two white kids and about 58 Black kids. And we had played that football season together. I was in the, sixth grade, and my brother was in the seventh. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life, even today, looking back on it, because my brother and I, we were actually friends with these kids. This wasn't, just the two token white kids. That's kind of in reverse of what you normally hear. But and it was one of the greatest experiences that I've ever had. Now, moving to King, North Carolina, completely different in high school, because there just weren't nearly the amount or the number of Black kids there. But there were no problem. I don't think there weren't. I mean, there wasn't any problems, any race relation problems there. But now, when I moved to Alabama, and because this was after I graduated from law school in '92, not that there were any big race problems down here when I got here, but it's a different kind of attitude, I think, about race relations in what I will call the Deep South, which is like Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, as opposed to Tennessee and North Carolina and Virginia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the reason that question came up for me when I was hearing you write about football and sort of the South is, like I said, I grew up in a small Texas town, and there were definitely undertones of racism. Like, I remember very distinctly, I had a friend, we had a Black kid who got stabbed at our school. Like, they got in a fight. And, I had this very close friend, and his parents were very, very kind to me. And there were days when I would hear things come out of their mouth, and it was just like blatant racism towards Black people, yet they didn't have the same attitudes towards me. And I think what always struck me about that was we weren't talking about uneducated rednecks. We're like talking with people with PhDs who come from the wealthiest families in town. And I just found that so striking that somebody who is so educated, somebody who is that wealthy, could have that attitude. It really, it was shocking every single time I heard it, because here I am, this kid in seventh grade, hearing his mom, my friend's mom, like make these racial slurs while driving me to school. And it just really struck me as so strange.
Yeah. And I've grown up with that too. I mean, that's, I don't think that's uncommon, but I tell you what I do think is happening now, or I think is every generation, like, I don't think our generation is not as racist as the last. And I think as you get away from say slavery, and I guess with 1860s, and the farther you get away from it, I think the better it has become. I mean, my kids aren't, I mean, there's no racist thought that I think ever enters their heads. But I did grow up, and I think, and as you said too, even other kids' parents would make, just kind of the snide comments sometimes. And I wasn't raised like that. So, I mean, and it's not like I wouldn't say anything. I just kind of, listen to it and kind of, okay.
Well, I think it's interesting, being an Indian person, and I'm not saying this out of ego, but like people kind of view us as sort of a model minority, right? Like, what do Indians do? We start companies, we become doctors and engineers and lawyers. But I've even heard racist things come out of my own parents' mouths where I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. Why did you say that? But, I want to come back to the race thing when we talk about your career as a lawyer, because I think there's a lot of interesting ties there. But let's go back to this moment, in rehab. The thing that really struck me at the beginning is, you said maybe because of my youth or brain condition, I was always upbeat in the days following surgery. I smiled and laughed at my family and friends who came to visit. My smile was actually genuine. Oddly, I was never depressed. My life had been forever changed, but for some reason, I was always genuinely upbeat. And that stood in such stark contrast to that, moment in Friday Night Lights when you get to the second episode and Jason Street is like, on the verge of breaking up with his girlfriend and all hell breaks loose. And, what is it like? Why is it that you had this response to such a tragic situation and other people don't?
I'm not sure. Although I'm not sure everybody, would have a different attitude on it with they had their tragic situation. But I think I tell you what, I think it goes back to when I had the accident, I had my life prior to that was about as spectacular as it could be. And, so your personality is based on that. And so you have this level of confidence, that is ingrained in you. And so when this happened, your personality just does not change overnight. So you're still the same person inside that, you know, this whole 15 years of your life, this person that and personality that's been created. You have this horrible, tragic event. Now you're lying in a hospital bed and you cannot move anything, you know, below the neck. But what you've brought into it stays with you. And so, and I don't know why it was that, I genuinely stayed upbeat. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't have a day or two where, you know, I had some bad days. But for the most part, yeah, I was genuinely an upbeat person. You know, I guess it was the, you know, especially once I started being able to move, you know, some stuff again, it was, all right, let's get into rehab and let's see what we can do and see what we're going to have left to move on with my life.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's interesting to me is you did far more than move on with your life. I mean, you went on to become class president, you had girlfriends, you were a valedictorian. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary considering that, you know, you faced adversity that would probably, you know, derail the average person. So I guess where I want to start is, you know, how did this end up affecting your friendships and your relationships? Because again, like, you know, your story, like other than the moment of the injury, when I compare it to the you know, Friday Night Lights TV show where this guy's girlfriend dumps him, his friendships change, yours is like the polar opposite. You know, your girlfriend stayed with you, you became class president. So I had to ask, you know, how did this end up in fact affecting your social relationships and your relationship with your family?
Well, social relationships were not affected at all. I stayed friends with the friends I had. I had more friends even after it. Even today, I'm very close with my best friend from high school. We played basketball together. He didn't play football, but he played basketball. We're still great friends today. You know, about my girlfriend. You know, here I was coming in. I was going to be big man on campus. I decided I needed to break up with her before high school started, which I did. And then this happened, but she graciously took me back. You talk about a hit there. It makes you a little bit more humble. You know, when you have something like this. But and I dated her throughout high school, and then went off to college, and it was kind of how that goes. My friends never, like I said earlier, they did not ever treat me any differently. And my family was basically the same too. I mean, my brother's a year older than me. We've always been close. I've got three sisters. My parents are divorced now, but they were married throughout, all of my schooling, and they didn't get divorced till later on in life, but still very close to them. One thing, when you have an injury like this, it's taxing on your family. My mom was at the hospital and the rehab center every day, and we've got, at the time, my brother was at home and I had two sisters at home. They've got lives going on. My dad's out running his business. My grandmother came over to live with us for a while to do the cleaning and the cooking, and it's taxing. It's not just you or me that's affected by this. It affects everybody. And I think when I first got back to high school, I think my friends may have been a little, a little tepid, maybe, or not nervous, but treat me a little not nicer or anything, but just like I was a little more fragile, of a person than I was. But it didn't take long because I didn't really change as a person inside, and then things just started going on as they normally did.
So you went on to become a trial lawyer. What prompted your interest in the law, of all things?
My grandfather was a lawyer and a judge, and so that was kind of it. But I didn't have some burning desire to be a lawyer. I was more interested in business. I was an economics major undergrad, and I basically went on to law school because you know, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, and I didn't really know, you know, really what I wanted to do. So I just signed up for law school, and then off I went. And then, you know, I did the once I got there, I did the JD MBA program to get my master's in business, just because I was really probably more interested in that. But in my career, you know, I've just been a straight up lawyer without having the business part of what I studied has had nothing to do with being a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of why I wanted to talk about law in particular is because I think it's such an interesting career, particularly in the context of race, the fact that you're a lawyer in the South. You know, like when I think about the fact that you're in Mobile, like, I mean, I'm guessing you're probably very familiar with Brian Stevens' work on the, his Equal Justice Initiative project. And, you know, I mean, when you read a story like Just Mercy and you see what happens, you know, I've had, you know, criminal defense attorneys here. So I think we love the idea of, you know, justice being black and white, but it's not. You know, I mean, and you're a lawyer. Why is that? You know, like, why is it? It seems to me like this system does not really, it's not equal justice.
Well, first of all, I do not do any criminal work.
Yeah.
But now I'll tell you, one of my best friends, you know, I hit the gym every morning, you know, before work. And one of my best friends, you know, does the same, and he is a criminal defense lawyer. And you know, he'll tell me, he'll say, look, you know, when we live on the other side of Mobile Bay, we got about a 10-mile, you know, or 8 to 10-mile trip across Mobile Bay to downtown Mobile is where we work. And one of the ways you can get across either the interstate or what's known as the causeway, which is the highway that goes across, you know, it's part land and part water, part bridge. But he said, and he tells me, he goes, look, when I see policemen, you know, have people pulled over on the causeway, he goes, 9 times out of 10, they're black.
Yeah.
Not the policeman, but who's getting pulled over. And, you know, I've never noticed that because, you know, him being a criminal defense lawyer, he sees this more than I do. And so it's more, you know, it's more apparent and it's more part of his life that that's what he sees. And, you know, why that is, I guess that's why we're going through what we're going through today with, with the Black Lives Matter. It's real. There's no doubt about it. But further to the question was, you know, why justice isn't the same or fair and I don't know. I mean, just getting on beyond a black and white or a racial thing is, you know, I remember when I first started practicing, I thought judges, you know, here I am, I guess what I'm 24, 25 years old, I guess, 26 when I first started practicing law. And so you go in, you're just some, you know, you're new and you get into the courtroom for the first time. And these judges, you know, they're all so much older. Most of them were male with white hair and gray hair. And you thought that oh my God, these must be the wisest people that there is. And they'll follow the law and they're going to make these incredible wise decisions. Well, but the thing is, what I've learned is, you know, judges, you know, when they make decisions on cases or, you know, in legal matters, you know, they bring their personality and their political views into that office. You know, you got plaintiffs oriented judges, you got defense oriented judges, you got judges that are down the middle. I mean, there's some judges down here that, you know how they're going to rule on something, but before you even file a motion, you know if you're going to win it or not, because if they're, you know, I'm a defense lawyer, and if, I mean, some judges are very plaintiffs oriented, and they're not, like, say you file a motion for summary judgment, which is something that, you know, gets the case thrown out as a matter of law, even though you think it's due to be granted, you know, going in, it's not going to be. And that's just, you know, you don't have these aren't computers up there that get all the information and process it and come out with what should be the correct decision. You know, these are people up there making decisions, and they're their past and their experiences go into and their biases go into their decisions.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about next is biases. So, you know, I had Sean Eskenazi here, who was a, you know, former criminal defense attorney, turned chocolate maker. And one of the things that he said that really struck me, we were talking about plea bargains. And he said, you know, people take plea bargains all day long for crimes they didn't commit because they're so terrified of the alternative, which is basically a much lengthier sentence. He said, if anybody went to trial, he said, if half these people actually went to trial the way they, you know, are supposed to be able to, the entire system would break down. So, you know, what I wonder is when you have biases embedded into people, and, you know, of course, all of us have biases, is there any way to achieve some level of objectivity in the system?
Well, yeah, because of the way the jury system works. I mean, you're going to have, and what I'm saying, I mean, so you're going to have 12 in Alabama, you're going to have 12 people on a jury in a criminal or any case that's in the state court system. And so the way you get objectivity is if you get jurors that, you know, really you want the biases to equal out. You know, you got people on the left, you got people on the right. So what you want is a decision that comes out, you know, that takes away biases because they got to work it out. And then you get that final decision or, you know, the verdict. And that's the way you want it. That's why in what I do, you know, jury selection is so important. You know, mm-hmm. making sure it's not that you get the right jurors. You just want to make sure you don't get the wrong jurors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so it kind of makes me wonder, I mean, you being a lawyer in a place like Mobile, Alabama, I mean, you know, you kind of alluded to it. When you see what's happening right now in this country as a lawyer, you know, particularly a lawyer in the South, you know, what do you make of it? You know, in your mind, what is our path to change here? A change that actually leads us to a better place.
Well, see, and that's the problem with all this. You know, I see the demonstrations, you know, some peaceful, I see the riots, and it seems like it's all really, I mean, what the stimulus for all that was, or what was the, you know, it started with, you know, the one up in Minnesota where the cop is kneeling on the guy's neck and then he dies, which, you know, and everybody sees that video and you're just like, oh my God, this is, I mean, if you watch that and think that's okay, I mean, I think there's something wrong with you. But that's, I mean, and then all the past, it's the white cops killing the black guys. And that's kind of that's the way this has kind of all started. And there must be some sort of a problem there, but being down here in Mobile, Alabama, I don't stay in some ivory tower where I go to work. I mean, I'm out in the community somewhat. I don't see this systemic racism at the ground level. Wow. I mean, I've got a black kid who's my little brother. We started off in Big Brothers, Big Sisters. When he was probably in the third grade, I'd go see him at his elementary school once a week. And now he is a sophomore in high school. And what we do now is, you know, about once a month or maybe a little more frequently, you know, I come, I pick him up, and we go out, we either, you know, we have lunch, we go to the movies, we hang out, we just talk. And so, you know, I see nothing, you know, between the two of us, of course. I mean, it's just it's a wonderful relationship. But I mean, I see his friends and stuff. And, you know, I don't see this racism, at least not in any form that is, you know, palpable or just, you know, right out in the open. And it may be because Alabama was, you know, like in Mississippi, were so bad for so long that I think racism down here is probably not as bad as it is in other states.
Yeah. That makes me kind of wonder, you know, I think what I wonder is misperceptions? Because, you know, I mean, I'm a liberal person who grew up in California, of all places, where it's incredibly diverse. And, you know, I mean, it's very clear, like, you know, very few people in where I live, you know, tend to vote Trump. And, you know, I wonder, what misperceptions do you think that somebody like me or people like, you know, myself and you know, my peers who basically consume media that would be considered, you know, left biased media have about places like mobile? Because I think that in our minds, I think our stereotype of Alabama, which isn't entirely accurate. And I, you know, this is something I even learned in Texas. My mom commented, you know, when we moved to California, she said, you know, she's like, I think I miss about being in College Station is people are so friendly there. Like, you go to a bar in Texas or you go into a restaurant, people are just friendly. They talk to you. Whereas, you know, you go to a grocery store in California, people are like, get on. There's other people here.
Yeah. Well, that's how it is. I mean, in Mobile, it's a friendly place. You know, you go to the grocery store, you go to bars, you go to restaurants. It's, yeah, people talk with each other. It's kind of a nice place to be. But, you know, I think, though, the perception of Alabama going so far back and the way it's been portrayed in movies, you know, although, you know, like Mississippi Burning, of course, that was over in Mississippi. But then you got, you know, like the up in Selma, the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I mean, that stuff happened. I mean, I think it takes a long time to even attempt to erase those memories, which, I mean, I don't think you ever want to completely erase that memory anyway, because, you know, I think you need your history out there. But, I mean, there was some bad stuff going on in the Deep South. And, you know, I think there's a museum in Montgomery, I think, that has all the, it's got, you know, stories or at least the names of all the black people that were lynched and killed in Alabama. And it's just, I've not been there. I want to go, but, I mean, it's gotta be haunting just to go into a place like that. And that really happened. And, you know, you think today, you know, me, and I mean, I've always grown up in the South, although Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, they are the South, but it's really kind of more somewhat mid-Atlantic states, or at least, I don't consider that the Deep South. But down here, there was some bad stuff that went on. And you can't even, sitting here today, you probably can't even, it's hard to even imagine that people could be killed like they were, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, you know, in the United States like that. So I think, though, so the perception that you get, you know, if you're not from, you know, this, say you're not from Alabama, that you get this perception that Alabama is such a racist place. It's probably just from the past. But if, you know, if you spend any time here, you know, I don't think there's a huge racial problem down here. I mean, like, even in Mobile, there's not been like huge protests. Haven't been any rioting down here, and, you know, Mobile, I mean, the city of Mobile is probably 40% black.
Yeah, wow. So, you know, the other thing I wonder is, having had the life experience you had, you know, having had such a tragic injury, how did that shape and influence the kind of parent you've been, and the messages that you've passed on to your kids?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm not sure. It has shaped me as far as a parent that much, because I still, even after the injury, I went on to lead the life I wanted to lead, regardless of the injury. And so, you know, the way I lead my life, and I have always since I had my injury, is, I mean, this is just something I've got to deal with, but I'm not going to allow it to affect, you know, the decisions I make and how I go forward in my life. I mean, although I'm not going to, I'm not going to take a job as somebody who's going to be, you know, building houses or doing anything.
Yeah.
That's not in the realm of possibility. But, and it's really, you know, even looking back on it, and when you ask me that question, I guess it's really kind of almost surprising how that my injury didn't affect my personality so much. And that I was continuing to be competitive. I continued to strive to do the best I could. Like when one of my sons played football, you know, as a kid for a while, and I didn't prohibit it, but I tell you, I did not encourage it. I wasn't going to be one of those parents like, hey, you know, by God, you're going to get out there and play football because you're going to be a man. There's no way I would have done that, because if something would have happened bad, yeah, I wouldn't be the one, you know, to have pushed a son into that. You know, that would have been the worst thing. But my kids have, you know, from day one, they've known nothing else other than having a father with a major physical disability. And so, and I don't think they've ever been, I've got a great relationship with my kids. I don't think they've ever been like embarrassed to, you know, be walking around with me, or even, you know, when they're younger, you know, because, you know, all, you know, kids, I've gotten used to, you know, my oldest son, who was when he was in kindergarten, I would walk him to class every day because he was, you know, he was scared to go in. So, well, I walked him for like 30 days. So, you know, I'm walking, you got all these little kids over there, just, you know, as I'm walking, you can just see him staring and, you know, pointing and that kind of stuff. But my kids have never, I don't think they've ever been like, you know, embarrassed, like, oh, there's my dad who walks so funny. I'm trying to think if I've become a different parent because of my injury. I don't think so. I think I've taken the same personality, what I brought into the injury and then what I've learned after it, you know, into being a parent and just trying to be a loving, supportive parent who, I've wanted my kids to be, you know, as successful as possible. But, my wife and I really didn't push our kids. I didn't really push my kids, you know, to the brink of them, like, you know, just, you know, I just can't take this anymore. You got to get your grades up. You got to make all A's. You got to be the best athlete. You got to be this. Yeah. That's, you know, we've never done that. We've kind of let our kids kind of become their own people. Of course, the problem with that is, they made okay grades, but they certainly weren't at the top of their class. My two that went to college, they've graduated, and they're out working now, and so they seem to be very well adapted kids. And my wife and I did a pretty good job parenting them.
Yeah. So there's this theme that has, you know, showed up over and over in our conversation of the fact that you weren't going to let this thing define you, and you're going to live your life and, you know, push it to the limits of what's possible regardless. And this is something I've asked people in some form or another, the sort of relativity of grief, you know, so people have far worse responses to far less dire situations than the one that you're in. Why is that?
You know, I don't know what's going on in the heads of some other people on why they do this. I mean, it's it may be, you know, what happened in their life before what the event they had, whether it be minor or a major event. I mean, if your personality or your level of confidence, or if you're not a happy person going into something, and then something bad happens, and it may not even be, you know, not that I've ever wanted to compare tragic events, but if somebody, you know, has something that you would think maybe not be that big of a deal, and they just fall apart, you know, it might be that because, you know, the type of person they were coming into it. Like, you know, I was a very strong, confident person when this happened. And so I continued with that. You know, I guess if I, you know, had issues of self-doubt or, you know, problems like that when when this happened. Maybe the effort or the move on and try to live your best life. Maybe it wouldn't have been there. It's hard to say really to me why people don't, or why people, some people just kind of quit and fall apart. Why they do, you know, it's, I really don't know.
Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating. I've really enjoyed chatting with you and learned a ton. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Give me the definition of unmistakable so I can answer
it. So my definition of unmistakable, because I wrote a book called Unmistakable, and you have to define it apparently when you write a book called that, is something that is so distinctive that nobody else could have done it but you.
Well, it's hard to say that nobody could have achieved what I did after my injury, because I'm sure there's people out there that have had horrible injuries or horrible physical things happen to them that have done just as well or better than I have. But I think what's different about me is, well, I mean, it was the constant drive to be successful and to live a great life. All right, I've got this physical disability. So knowing I'm going to struggle physically every day, I'm going to struggle to walk, you know, to class in college. I'm going to struggle to walk into the office every day. I'm going to struggle to walk in the courtroom. But you don't let the physical struggle, you know, change what you want the outcome to be, which is, you know, I want to live a great life. You know, we got one life. I mean, this is it. And so you have one part of your life that is not the greatest, the physical, like for me, the physical part of it. I'm not going to let that screw up the rest of it. And so, I mean, to me, it's all of this quest for just having a great life, because this is all you got, you know, and if you quit, you know, well, then there goes your life. So I guess, you know, to sum it up, I'm all about just having the best, you know, I want to lead the best life I can lead. I want to be as happy as I can. I want to do as many great things as I can. I just want to have a great life.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your book, your work, and everything else you're up to?
Yeah, my book is, the best way to do it is just go on Amazon and get it. It's called Get Back Up. Although I do have a website, which is not much more than a landing page. It's www.rodkate.com. But, you know, if people want to follow me, I've got a YouTube channel. If they just want to, you know, put Rod Kate in there, I've got some, you know, I've given some talks. I've got some videos of me working out on there. So if you're curious to see how I walk and how I do my physical stuff, I put some of the workout stuff on YouTube, and, you know, I've got an Instagram account, just, you know, look up Rod Kate. I've got some photos on there, that kind of stuff.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.